You know, we could just sit. What do you think, huh? Sometimes it's hard to break the silence. So today, as we've been doing, of course, we met with half of you in mostly individual interviews. And certainly in the conversations I was having, not only were we talking about the retreat and what was happening there, but there's a little bit, you know, the mind begins to turn into next, you know, the day after tomorrow kind of thing. It's a long ways away. You could imagine it's still another week before Sunday arrives. That'd probably be a useful way to hold it. But still, the question comes up, okay, this is great. We're doing this here. And how do I carry it forward? So when the Buddha was dying, he said to the people who were gathered around him, he said, be a light unto yourselves. Be a lamp. And it's kind of astounding, isn't it? Here we are, 2,600 years later, still listening to what that man said. Talk about a lamp. I mean, he was apparently quite amazing. And the many, many, many people who have followed after him, the men and the women, the monks and the nuns and the lay people, have also been illuminated by that light and have left words to teach us with, have words to light us up so that we're all, it's kind of fun. I can look around. It's like you're all little lamps sitting there on your cushions, radiating out your awakeness. So the question always is, of course, you know, how can I be a lamp? How do I carry it forward? That's one question. And the other one that comes up usually is moi, me, be a lamp? I don't think so. But that's what he suggested, is that we could all be lamps. So we've had these conversations with you, and we know some of you quite well because you've been with us one way or another for a while. And we certainly know, I certainly know, that you are doing quite amazing things in your work and in your lives, and that you are, in fact, already lamps. Because you are. So I thought what I would do tonight is bring some stories and some images that might support this work of being a lamp, that might help to keep you grounded, might nourish the light that's there, keep you connected to the teachings. So these are going to be a series of instructions from a few bears and a bird, a couple of birds. So the first story is that of a baby quail. This is a Jataka tale. So this is a story of a being of the Buddha before he had the incarnation of being the Buddha that we know. And he was born to Mama and a Papa quail. And I'm just going to read you a few of the lines because I love the way this particular version of the story tells it. And he said, and it says, although he had little feet and wings, he could not yet walk or fly. So this is a very little baby quail. And of course, this is quite significant to all of us in this part of the world these days. In the forest, a fire began because that happens in forests quite regularly. And, you know, a lot of the birds left and the animals left, but the mom and dad quail hung in there with that baby absolutely as long as they could until there was nothing to do except to leave. So they flew away in order to save their lives. So there he is, you know, he's in the nest. And he could do nothing to save himself. He was way too small. So he was overwhelmed, it says, by hopelessness. Who wouldn't be? And then this thought occurred to him. My parents loved me very much. Unselfishly, they built a nest for me and then fed me without greed. When the fire came, they remained with me until the last moment. All the other birds who could have flown away had flown away a long time before. So great was the loving kindness of my parents that they stayed and risked their lives, but still they were helpless to save me. Since they could not carry me, they were forced to fly away alone. I thank them, wherever they are, for loving me so. I hope with all my heart they will be safe and well and happy. Now I am all alone. There's no one I can go to for help. I have no wings. I have wings, but I cannot fly away. I have feet, but I cannot run away. But I can still think. All I have left to use is my mind, a mind that remains pure. The only beings I have known in my short life were my parents, and my mind has been filled with loving kindness toward them. I have done nothing unwholesome to anyone. I am filled with newborn, innocent truthfulness. And then it says this innocent truthfulness grew and became larger than the baby bird and actually spread beyond that lifetime and ultimately was embodied within the Buddha. So that baby quail was the Buddha to be. I love that story. There's actually a lovely chant that the nuns do that I probably should learn. It would be fun. We don't know what happened, but presumably the baby quail died because he was stuck. And the commitment of that baby quail to awakening continued. So I don't think, you know, we have to arrange to die in a fire. That sounds pretty horrendous. But I think we do need to consider the impact that just following the path of awakening has. Just that commitment to waking up that each of you carries in your own heart. You don't know where it will lead. We're often not so very aware of the light that we do shed. And most of the time, we don't get to see the results when we practice and when we do things. It's planting seeds. I think of, you know, I worked as a therapist for many years before I actually shifted over to doing nothing but teaching meditation practice. And so often, I'd work with somebody for a few months or even a year or so, and then they would leave. For one reason or another, sometimes they just disappeared, sometimes they had to move, all different kinds of things. And often I didn't really know what happened next. Once in a while, because I lived here and at that time it was a relatively small community, you know, I'd see somebody, I'd bump into them someplace, and they would sometimes say, you remember when you said blah, 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 blah? And I never remembered that I had said that ever. But they would say, it was so important. It changed my life. I've carried it around with me for forever. Once I even got an email from a young man that I had worked with here years ago, years and years ago, probably more years than some of you are old. And he had been a student up at the university, and he was a preacher's kid, and he was gay. And he was having a really hard time trying to figure out how to come out of the closet, how to live his life as a gay man. And we walked together for quite a while. And then he felt finished enough and left. It was only in the last 3 or 4 years I got an email one day. And it said, hi, you maybe don't remember me, but... And he'd gone on to move away from Santa Cruz and away from the parents, be partnered, be very happy, had a very successful career as an artist. It was such a gift. It was such a gift to hear that at least that particular seed had sprouted. So that's the baby quail. That commitment to awakening is very, very powerful. So the next instructor is an elephant. So when the Buddha teaches about the quality of faith, or you could translate it as conviction, or you could translate it as trust in the practice, one of the images he gives us is of what it would be to find an elephant in the jungle. Now, it's important to remember that in the time of the Buddha, elephants were very, very important helpers on farms and could do a lot of the heavy lifting, quite literally. And so if you could find one and capture it, it was a very cool thing to do. So the Buddha says, it's like you're wandering through the forest, maybe out here, you know, behind the center, and you notice, there's some footprints. And then maybe after a while, you see that there's some branches that the elephant has grabbed in order to eat. And you begin to get the sense that there really is an elephant there. And so he says it's like that for all of us, that we see the signs of something that we can trust. We begin to see the traces of it. And we can follow it. We can trust that maybe there is some awakening around. Maybe there is some awakening that's available to me. And I think it's really true that some of you have had glimpses of that this week. I've heard you say so. You know, moments when you saw into your own suffering, perhaps, the nature of it, or you saw something about impermanence, or maybe even the lack of solidity of this thing that we call self. And, of course, this won't stop once the retreat is over. You can continue to look for that elephant of awakening. You can look for those, that faith and trust in your everyday life. Your regular practice of meditation, of study, will lead to more glimpses and perhaps a face-to-face meeting with some aspect of awakening. The retreat does not end on Sunday. This is the prologue to the real thing. The real thing begins on Sunday when you get into your cars and various modes of transportation and head off into the outer world. So everyday life can become the ground of awakening. And I must say, I want to always put this in, intimate relationships, deep friendships, partners can be an enormous teacher, an enormous source of awakening. If you want to know where you're not cooked yet, that's the place to find out. They will be happy to tell you. They will. Yeah. So the next one, we have a bear. We have the first bear as an instructor. And this comes actually from a story by William Faulkner. It's actually called The Bear. And he talks in the story about a family in the mountains in the south, which is where he wrote about a lot, who had followed a particular bear for a year. They'd been trying to, they were bear hunters, and they were trying to find this bear. And this young boy, Sam, hears about this, and he sees his family going out year after year after year. They never catch this bear. Over and over this happens, and he hears all the stories about this very big, amazing bear. And then at some point, he decides he's going to go too. And so he heads out into the woods, and he too, he sees an enormous paw print, and it's missing some toes, which he had heard about. And he can smell the bear smell, so he knows the bear is there, but he never sees it. Never sees the bear. And he goes again and again and again. Never sees the bear. Finally, he talks to an old Indian fellow who's around where he lives. And the Indian says, "You're carrying a gun. You can't do that." leave the gun at home. You have to go unarmed. So he heads out again without a gun, which is, you know, you can imagine he's just a little kid and he's scared and but still. And he takes only his watch and his compass. So that's kind of you on this retreat, right? Presumably you've left your guns at home. We certainly hope so in today's culture. But you come here kind of vulnerable because you have left a lot of stuff at home. You've left, like we talked about earlier in the retreat, you've left your regular way of life and all of your favorite things to do and all of that. And you come with your hands kind of empty and open. And you probably still, some of you have a sense of time, although I know people do leave their watches sometimes at home. And you probably do have some sense of place and direction, like he had his compass. But Sam still didn't see the bear. So at one point, deep in the woods, he takes off the watch and he takes off his compass and he puts them down and he walks away, he walks on. And after a bit, he tries to find where he left them and he can't find them. So he's really, really lost. So he sits down on a log in this little glade that he's found and he waits. So in everyday life, it's kind of difficult to set aside time and space, you know, to be alone and to practice, but it can be done. So sometimes you set aside this time and you watch, you know, you turn off the notifications on your phone, maybe, God forbid, but it's a good idea, you know, or you don't check your messages every time you turn around and stop for a breath, or maybe you even take what one of my monk friends calls a desert day, where you do leave all that stuff at home and take a whole day where kind of you are on retreat like you are here and where you can live by the nature, the rhythm of nature and the rhythm of your own heart. So when you're lost, being lost is pretty interesting and it can be really helpful when you might feel as though you don't have anyone there to help you. You don't know where to go next. But this is good. You know, there's a lovely poem. I'm not going to read you the whole thing, but by David Wagoner called Lost. And he says at the end, He says, "You are surely lost in the forest." He's talking about stand still. The forest knows where you are. You must let it find you. You must let it find you. Let awakeness find you. So in our story, the boy waits. He waits and he waits. And suddenly he realized this enormous female bear is there. And she glides by. And she stops. And she looks at him. And then she disappears into the forest. And it changed him. You know, he nobody ever caught the bear. But he did see her. So, like Sam, we have to empty ourselves now and then in order to open to the new. There's a saying in the Quaker world that I absolutely love. It says, "Way opens." It doesn't say the way opens. It just says, "Way opens." But I think way does not open until we are well and truly lost, actually. He doesn't get to keep her. She doesn't stay. I think that's important to notice, too. She doesn't stay. He doesn't get to keep her. But he knows that he has seen her. So the next instructions are about the heart. And the first instructors, your next instructors, are Raven and Mrs. Bear. And this is from a book of koans that Robert Aitken Roshi put together, and they're based on animals. So Black Bear, Mrs. Bear, comes to a meeting late, comes into the meditation hall late. Raven is the teacher. And she says, I am feeling frazzled after dealing with my cubs, my kids. What if I don't feel compassionate? So all of you who have had anything to do with raising children, so that's probably everybody, even if you don't have any of your own, you know, what if I don't feel compassionate? That was kind of like the question we had the other day. And Raven says, fake it. That doesn't seem honest, said Black Bear. It doesn't begin with honesty, said Raven. I love this story because there's always that place where we go, what? You know, fake it. So we've wrestled with this a lot in this group. You know, what about compassion and how to keep the heart open and how to work with all the different Brahma Viharas? And our world's a mess right now. It's a really, what's that phrase? It's a hot mess? It's a hot mess. It is. And it's so difficult. And we all have people in our lives who are difficult. I have neighbors in my road association, and we have to take care of our own road, fill our own potholes, trim all the brush, all that kind of stuff, as we say there, I can't work with them. They're impossible. They're very, very difficult people. I meet hundreds of visitors in the national park where I work as a volunteer, and some are really busy being rude and demanding and mean, sometimes to me, often to each other, and sometimes to their children. It's very difficult to be around. And, you know, I have this amazing and wonderful husband that I've been with for 40 years. He's geeky as the day is long. He gets in front of his computer, lost in whatever his software project is, or the music that he's composing, or sometimes he's shooting tanks. And I'm not very excited about these things. And he's lost. He's lost. He's got his headphones on, for one thing. I mean, truly, I think I could fall over someday, and he won't know. I don't know. I might have to wear a smartwatch or something, but I don't even know if that would do it. So we have these people. How do we be compassionate? You know, fortunately, I do still love him dearly, so that one's not too hard. But some of the others are really, really hard. Really hard. So this is exactly what our practices do. You sit here. You say, may I be happy. May I be peaceful. May she be happy. May she be peaceful. May they be happy. May they be peaceful. You maybe feel it, but you maybe don't, because the practice, it says in all of the practice, do it for the difficult people, the people who make your teeth clench, and you don't want to do it really because you don't like them very much. And the instruction is, and if you come to me to say, what should I do? I don't like this person very much. I don't want to do metta. And I will say, do it anyway. In AA, as some of you know, I know, they say fake it until you make it. There's that way where you're practicing being kind. You're practicing sending your mind towards kindness and compassion, goodwill, friendliness, all of that. And when we practice, it begins to create neuronal pathways in the mind and the heart. And gradually, it begins to happen. That's what the Buddha did in that wonderful story that we heard last night during the metta practice when he taught the monks to do the metta suttas. And I'm sure they weren't feeling confident and kind. They were terrified. They were terrified of those weird creatures that were inhabiting the forest where they thought they were going to be peaceful. So, you know, you can imagine Mrs. Bear, she goes home. The kids are still being squirrely. They've probably made a mess or done something else. You know, the kids are kids. They haven't changed. But maybe she can take a deep breath and find a way to be a bit more patient and a bit kinder. And And things move along. Gradually, she becomes more compassionate. So we have another instructor, another elephant. And this one comes from the story of the Buddha. It's more about the heart. So this is the story of the Buddha's cousin, Devadatta. And Devadatta, he kind of wanted to be the Buddha, really. And he was very jealous. And he had many, many different plots to kill the Buddha. So in this particular story, he puts a large bull elephant in a stable. And he feeds him buckets of hard liquor. And so gets the elephant pretty drunk and pretty unable to control himself. And then he beats him until he's just filled with rage and waits until the Buddha comes along on his evening walk and lets the elephant loose. So here's the Buddha walking along, and the Buddha takes one look at the elephant. And he feels great love and compassion for this wild beast. And he stands where he is, and he radiates loving kindness towards this rage-filled elephant. And it's said in the story, and this is, of course, the Buddha, that his love and compassion were so powerful that the elephant stopped. He could feel it. And he calmed down, and then he bowed down to the Buddha, respectfully bowed its head, and the Buddha stroked the elephant's trunk. I always like that bit, and comforted it with a few kind words. Now, I don't think the Buddha was faking it, actually. I think the Buddha was a Buddha, and he was filled with compassion. And I don't think I could do that. But we're called to do it, aren't we, sometimes? We have all kinds of difficult, rage-filled beasts in our lives. And we learn how to meet them sometimes. We learn to pause, to take that deep breath before you open your mouth. I was saying to somebody today, sometimes I have to go into the bathroom and shut the door. You know, that's a great refuge when you're really annoyed, because then you can calm down a little and figure out what's the skillful thing to do, and then go back out and try to ease things so you don't have a war, you know? And you do the best you can. I think that's a really important part of this practice, is that as we practice these things, we maybe it's not perfect. You don't succeed 100%, but you do the best you can. And gradually your willingness to move forward into kindness and compassion helps to ease things, maybe prevent another war in your own life. And even though the elephant, whatever the elephant is, doesn't actually bow down. So then the last bit. So the last instruction comes from the human animal, and it's about gratitude. And I know I probably could have hunted around and found any number of cute stories about grateful animals, because they're all over the internet and you see them on YouTube all the time. But I like this one better. And it comes from my fellow Dharma teacher, James Barras. It's been mentioned, I'm not sure if in here, but someplace I was this week, it was mentioned. And James Barras had a mother who's passed now. And she was pretty grumpy. And she was kind of annoyed that her son, who should have been a doctor, had become a meditation teacher. And, you know, just wasn't always the easiest mom. Maybe none of us are, but she wasn't. But somewhere towards in the last years of her life, she decided that she would take on the practice of gratitude. And there's a lovely little video that you can find where she talks about this, about how it utterly changed her, just work, and it was very simple. She just practiced thank you all the time. Thank you, thank you, thank you, no matter what happened. W.S. Merwin says this about gratitude. He says, listen. With the night falling, we are saying thank you. Back from a series of hospitals, back from a mugging, after funerals, we are saying thank you. After news of the dead, whether or not we knew them, we are saying thank you. Over telephones, we are saying thank you. In doorways and in the backs of cars and in elevators, remembering wars and the police at the door, in the faces of the officials and the rich, and of all who will never change, we go on saying, thank you, thank you, thank you. With the animals dying around us, we are saying thank you. With the forests falling faster than the minutes of our lives, we are saying thank you. With the cities growing over us, we are saying thank you, faster and faster. With nobody listening, we are saying thank you. Thank you, we are saying, and waving, dark though it is. That's important. It's dark. It's really dark now. Every now and then there's little glimmers of moonlight coming through the cracks in the ceiling, but it's pretty dark. And it's important to learn to say thank you. So Vipassana practice, as some of you have noticed, because I've heard you say so, it's pretty dry. Pretty grim sometimes. Everybody's walking around, keeping their eyes down, being very silent. There's not much singing. There's not much dancing. There's no alleluias. It's just, So it's hard sometimes. And David Steindl-Rast, who's a wonderful teacher, he's a Benedictine monk, he says, the root of joy is gratefulness. It is not joy that makes us grateful. It is gratitude that makes us joyful. So that's important, I think, when we're trying to add that element to this dry practice of wisdom. So, you know, the Buddha gave those monks the metta practice, and they were very scared, as I said, going back into the forest. And we're all afraid, aren't we? I mean, I imagine if you were all honest, I certainly am afraid sometimes, a lot of the time now. I think we're all afraid. And we're headed off into the forest. And the Buddha says, here, this is what to do. You know, this is what should be done. It's exactly how that sutta starts out. And so we're doing our best to be awake, to befriend our lives, to befriend the people around us. So I think it's important to remember that we can turn things around. We can react out of fear and upset, or we can begin to meet events in our lives with some interest and even some curiosity. You know, Ajahn Sumedho, I've mentioned this several times, when he would teach, he would say, well, anger comes up in the hall. He said, great, this is what anger is like. You're sitting there and all of a sudden you're filled with fear and anxiety. Great, this is what fear and anxiety are like. Learn to be present with them and meet them and to be taught by them. You know, how, the question always is, how do I use this to wake up? Can whatever it is, or whoever it is, be my teacher? Which, of course, when you begin to hold it that way, allows you to begin to be grateful to everyone. Because everyone, everyone is your teacher. Everyone. Every event is your teacher. The difficult people on my road are my teachers. You know? Donald Trump and Elon Musk and all that crowd are our teachers. They are. We don't like them much. They're not your favorite professor, but they are your teachers. The accident on the side of the road is your teacher. How can we use it? So everything is a gift. I don't know who said this, but I had the quote. I like it. Everything is a gift. The degree to which we are awake to this truth is a measure of our gratefulness, and gratefulness is a measure of our aliveness. While I was working on this talk this afternoon, I remembered a piece from a novel written by a woman I knew years and years ago. She was a Jungian analyst and a teacher of mine, and very, very interested in Navajo mythology. She's been gone a long time, but she wrote a couple of wonderful children's books, and one of them is called Knee Deep in Thunder, and it's about some kids who are actually on a journey. And again, more animal teachers. The teacher in this case is a beetle. I hadn't thought about that when I was working on the talk, but now we have a beetle as well as elephants and bears and the baby quail. I wonder where we are going, I said. Wherever the way is going, Exe replied calmly. Exe is the beetle. But where do you suppose the way is going? Wherever we go. That doesn't really make sense, does it? Oh, yes, quite good sense. Why? Do you know any method by which you can go one way and your path another? Not the path, but your path. Well, I hesitated. Well, if you put it that way, I guess not. But what about crossroads? Couldn't you choose the wrong one? And Exe says, I suppose you could. However, if it was the wrong way you chose, it would still be your way, wouldn't it? Yes, I answered, it probably would. Even the wrong way can be a gift, right? It's very interesting to begin to hold our lives that way. We can be grateful when you thoroughly blow it. And you do, and we have, and you will, and I will. This is where I need to work. This is, you know, to pay attention. To pay attention to all the places where you take offense at things. That's probably where you need to work. Your own lostness and confusion can be the Buddha in disguise, challenging you to wake up. So the Buddha says, be a light, follow awakening, be lost and keep going, practice kindness, and be grateful. In the end, we are back at the beginning. It comes around to intention and to motivation. That's where we started this retreat, right? What is your intention for being here? The quail was motivated. He sure was. Whew. Sam was motivated. Mrs. Bear was motivated. The Buddha had astounding motivation and intention. And you are motivated. You are motivated. You have been so strongly motivated that here you are still at the end of a week of practice. So we learn to give thanks for all of life and death, for all of this, you know, in this given world of ours. And when we do that, we can find a deep joy. It's the joy of trust, the joy of faith, and the faithfulness at the heart of all things. It is the joy of gratefulness that touches the fullness of life. So here's something that the Buddha didn't say, but I think he would agree. Being grateful ends suffering. being grateful, and suffering. So I really invite you in hope. You know, here we are. We're in the last 36 hours of the retreat. So I'm hoping that you will continue with the same quality of motivation that you brought at the beginning, with the same openness of heart, and that you will then, when the time comes, carry that out with gratitude for everything that comes to meet you when you leave. So I'd like to end with one last poem. I just refound this afternoon, so, but I thought it fit. It's called For When People Ask, and the author is Rosemary Wotola Trommer. She says, I want a word that means okay and not okay. More than that, a word that means devastated and stunned with joy. I want the word that says, I feel it all at once. The heart is not like a songbird singing only one note at a time. More like a Tuvan throat singer, able to sing both a drone and simultaneously two or three harmonics high above it. A sound, the Tuvans say, that gives the impression of wind swirling among rocks. The heart understands a swirl, how the churning of opposite feelings weaves through us like an insistent breeze, leads us wordlessly deeper into ourselves, blesses us with paradox, so we might walk more openly into this world so rife with devastation, this world so ripe with joy. The heart understands swirl, how the churning of opposite feelings weaves through us like an insistent breeze, leads us wordlessly deeper into ourselves, blesses us with paradox, so we might walk more openly into this world so rife with devastation, this world so ripe with joy. So let's sit and breathe together for a moment.